Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Dani Beal, and I'm a longtime member of this beloved congregation. Joining me in welcoming you today are worship associate Deb Biggins and Hal Walker, our music director, along with guest musicians Brad Bolton and Christy Anderson. I also want to call to your attention that today at 11 a.m. following the service, we will be holding a vigil in front of our church for the numerous black faith communities who have been affected recently by violence and fire. Please join us as we stand in solidarity, witness, and grief. Lay-led services are a time-honored Unitarian Universalist tradition. We believe that the Sunday service is best reflected in a variety of voices and experiences. We are glad to have you with us this morning. We hope that you find something in the service today that nourishes your spirit and helps you find and keep your balance. Our minister, Reverend Melissa Carville-Zemer, is currently on leave, and we send our love to her growing family.
We light this chalice to celebrate the inherent worth and dignity of every person, to reaffirm the historic pledge of liberal religion, to seek that justice which transcends more legality and moves toward the resolution of true equality, and to share that love which is ultimately beyond even our cherished reason, that love which unites us. Where is our holy church? We are standing on the side of love. Many Unitarian Universalists suffer from a chronic identity crisis. People ask us, what do Unitarian Universalists believe? And we freeze. We don't know what to say because Unitarian Universalists believe so many things. So many different things. We are priests of paradox, apostles of ambiguity, nattering nabobs of nuisance. And so the Unitarian Universalist Association produces seven principles and six sources, and countless pamphlets and little wallet cards, all to remind us what we kind of sort of believe. We are exhorted to compose elevator speeches, summations of Unitarian Universalism, so pithy that might be recited on an elevator in its fleeting passage between floors. Do we believe in God? Question. Simple. Answer. Impossible. Define God. Define believe. Define we. Define in. Whatever God is or is not, I don't think God cares what we believe. I don't think Jesus cares what we believe, and I know that Buddha doesn't care what we believe. The important question is not what we believe, it's where we stand. I will be standing on the side of love. Or I want to be standing on the side of love, and I will be standing on the side of love. Of course, when I say standing, I'm not talking about a physical posture. Rosa Parks stood on the side of love by remaining in her seat. I'm talking about a moral stance, not just assumed privately in our hearts, but witnessed boldly in our families and schools and workplaces and communities, at the State House, in the halls of Congress. I'm talking about faith in action. I'm talking about sanctimony, I'm talking about intentionality, understanding that our practice will be imperfect as each of us is imperfect. What is our purpose? What is our aspiration? What is our commitment? Standing on the side of love. When Unitarian Lydia Maria Child defined the prohibition of her time against women speaking in public and demanded freedom for enslaved African Americans, and the vote for women, when she protested the Trail of Tears, the brutal removal of the Cherokee, she was standing on the side of love. When Unitarian Universalist minister Jim Reeb heeded the call of Martin Luther King Jr. to Selma, Alabama, and was bludgeoned to death by racists, he was standing on the side of love. When at the height of the debate over same-sex marriage in Massachusetts, this congregation voted to hang a banner over the church door proclaiming to every passerby, support marriage equality. We do. We were standing on the side of love. Standing on the side of love doesn't require power. It requires courage, because courage is power. Come, let us worship together.
As is our tradition, I will share these words of wisdom with you, and then we will join together in shared silence and meditation. Did you rise this morning, broken and hungover with weariness and pain, and rage tattered from waving too long in a brutal wind? Get up, child. Pull your bones upright. Gather your skin and muscle into a patch of sun. Draw breath deep into your lungs. You will need it, for another day calls to you. I know you ache. I know you wish the work were done and you were with everyone you have ever loved on a distant shore, safe and unafraid. But remember this, tired as you are not alone. Here also, there are others weeping and rising and gathering their courage. You belong to them, and they to you, and together we will break through and bend the arc of justice all the way down into our lives. Please join me in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life and love, spirit of mystery and wonder, God of all our understandings, we live in a time of intense joy and intense sorrow. As we celebrate the legal recognition of marriage for all people in the United States, we also mourn for those who have been taken by violence and mourn for those who do not feel safe in their own sanctuaries. These events have divided our nation, but do not have to divide our hearts. Help us to feel the depths of our souls, to be present and open to the experience and words of others, and to listen with ears wide open. Amen and blessed be.
The following is a statement made by Bree Newsom, the activist who climbed the flagpole at the South Carolina State House at dawn on June 27th.
And removed the Confederate flag. The night of the Charleston Massacre, I had a crisis of faith.
The people who gathered for Bible study in Emmanuel AME Church that night, Cynthia Marie Graham Heard, Susan Jackson, Ethel Lee Lance, DePayne Middleton, Dr. Tawanza Sanders, Daniel Simmons, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, Myra Thompson, and Reverend Clementa Pinckney, rest in peace. We are only doing what Christians are called to do when anyone knocks on the door of the church. Invite them in, fellowship, and worship. The day after the massacre, I was asked what next step was I, and said I didn't know. We've been here before, and here we are again. Black people slain simply for being black. An attack on the black church as a place of spiritual refuge and community organization. I refuse to be ruled by fear. How can America be free and be ruled by fear? How can anyone be? So earlier this week, I gathered with a small group of concerned citizens, both black and white, who represented various walks of life, spiritual beliefs, gender identities, and sexual orientations. Like millions of others in America and around the world, including South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and President Barack Obama, we felt and still feel that the Confederate battle flag in South Carolina hung in 1962 at the height of the civil rights movement, must come down. Of course, we are not the first to demand the flag's removal. Civil rights groups in South Carolina and nationwide have been calling for the flag's removal since the moment it was raised, and I acknowledge their efforts in working to remove the flag over the years via the legislative process. We discussed it and decided to remove the flag immediately, both as an act of civil disobedience and as a demonstration of the power of people have where we work together. Achieving this would require many roles, including someone must volunteer to scale the pole and remove the flag. It was decided that this role should go to the black woman and that a white man should be the one to help her over the fence as a sign that our alliance transcends both racial and gender divides. We made this decision because for us, This is not simply about a flag, but rather it's about abolishing the spirit of hatred and oppression in all its forms. I removed the flag not only in defiance of those who enslaved my ancestors in the southern United States, but also in defiance of the oppression that continues against black people globally in 2015, including the ongoing ethnic cleansing in the Dominican Republic. I did it in solidarity with the South African students who toppled a statue of the white supremacist, colonist Cecil Rhodes. I did it for all the fierce black women on the front lines of the movement and for all the little black girls who are watching us. I did it because I am free. As you are admiring my courage in that moment, please remember that this is not, never has been, and never should be just about one woman. This action required collective courage, just as this movement requires collective courage. I see no greater moral cause than liberation, equality, and justice for all God's people. What better reason to risk your own freedom than to fight for the freedom of others? That's the moral courage demonstrated yesterday by James Ian Tyson, who helped me across the fence and stood guard as I climbed. History will rightly remember him alongside the many white allies who, all over the centuries, have risked their own safety in defense of black life in the name of racial equality. It is important to remember that our struggle doesn't end when the flag comes down. Confederacy is a Southern thing, but white supremacy is not. Our generation has taken up the banner to fight battles many thought were won long ago. We must fight with all vigor so that our grandchildren are still fighting these battles in another 50 years. Black lives matter. This is non-negotiable. I encourage everyone to understand the history, recognize the problems of the present, and take action to show the world that the status quo is not acceptable. The last few days have confirmed to me that people understand the importance of action and are ready to take such action. Whether the topic is trending nationally or it's an issue affecting our local communities, those of us who are conscious must do what is right in that movement. And we must do it without fear. New eras require new models of leadership. This is a multi-leader movement. I believe that. I stand by that. I am because we are, I am one of many.
My first real girlfriend in college was a woman whom I'll call Mary, who was and is an Ohio State Trooper. We were quite the odd couple. This pacifist hippie loved that woman in the starched police uniform. She thought of herself as a social worker who used policing as her avenue of outreach and wanted very much to help people in any way she could. She understood the inequity in our justice system and did what she could do to try to address it in her daily activities and with her peers. She'd had training in community policing models and understood how her own bias could affect her decisions. I can remember watching her leave at night and understood that as a police officer, she was putting herself in harm's way daily, and there was always the possibility that she would not come home. For 3 years, I lived the life of a police officer's wife, and I quickly learned that this life consisted of a constant ache, a knowing that in a violent instant, everything can change. She's one of the many good ones out there. She fought the urge to assume that young black men are up to no good, and made an active decision to keep her biases in mind when assessing situations. She was very well trained, and unlike in many city police agencies, she'd also had training in how bias can affect police actions. I recently completed a program through Cleveland State University, which focuses on diversity and inclusion in organizations. As part of my final practicum, I studied the Department of Justice's report on the Cleveland Division of Police, and I have to tell you, the report does not focus on racial issues specifically, but on the lack of training, guidelines, and oversight for officers around their use of force policy, among other issues to do with how the division interacts with the. I was aware that many police departments do not train on issues of racial bias, working with people who are mentally ill, or community policing models, but I did not really understand up to that point how desperate the situation is. Up until recently in Cleveland, drawing a weapon was not considered a use of force according to the written policy and did not have to be reported in any way. Pistol whipping was so commonplace, that's when you hit somebody with the gun, was so commonplace there was a checkbox for it on the use of force continuum report, which even as it stood was not consistently completed after an incident. And the officers themselves did not even know the guidelines, even as imperfect as they were. Members of the community, many of whom were people of color, expressed fear and distrust of the police. And all of this was before Tamir Rice, before Michael Brown and Ferguson, before the other recent events which have given faces to these issues for many. There are so many issues I want to discuss with you about how and why we got to this point in our country where black people feel that their lives are not valued. Brad and Christy sang the words that Louis Armstrong sang years ago, "My only sin is in my skin. What did I do to become so black and blue?" I asked them to sing that song because the words haunt me, and my bias keeps me sometimes from hearing the deep pain that racism has brought upon many people. When I actually touch that pain in any way, it overwhelms me. When I think of the members returning to Mother Emanuel Church, when I think of those who do not have a church to return to because it has been burned to the ground, when I look out at the warm, loving light of this sanctuary, and I think of what it would feel like to not feel safe here, my heart hurts. So much pain and so much reckoning. Slavery is, of course, at the heart and beginning of this story. Most, but not all, black people in our country have slavery in their family history. Bree Newsom, whose words Deb shared earlier about her civil act of disobedience last week, traced her history and found that her great-great-grandfather was called Free Baby, as he was the first in her family to be born free. I want you all to think for a moment about your own family and consider your grandparents. Now think of their grandparents. For Bree, this was the generation that was the first to be born free. That just isn't that far back when looking at a family tree. But freedom from slavery certainly did not bring equality for black people, and the fight for civil rights has been long and arduous and continues today, as I see the Black Lives Matter movement to be a continuation of this fight. Some of the systemic issues facing the black community today are found in the criminal justice system, where there is a disparate impact on black people in how laws are created and enforced, specifically around drug laws. In the privatized prisons, where inmates of all colors become a form of profit, but blacks are very much overrepresented compared to their representation nationwide, and in the lack of training about racial issues and bias at the individual officer level. There are also historical issues from which we are still reeling, such as the way housing and taxation policies have segregated our communities and made it so that socioeconomic segregation has followed racial lines. Our taxation-based education system has created racial inequalities in our children's schools, and the lack of opportunities for young black people leaves little chance for anyone to break the cycle of oppression and violence. These are all higher-level issues, but individual and group bias plays a large role in how we respond to and address these issues. I'm a believer that we all have inherent bias, that our brains are structured to chunk information, and in doing so, bias becomes a part of our innate responses. I will share with you references later to learn more about all of these issues, but I want to highlight the book The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which examines the criminal justice system today. I also urge you to check out Harvard's Implicit Association Test, you can Google that, which uses immediate responses to help highlight for the user where their own biases around many aspects of different may be found. On to hashtags. For those of you who are not as tech savvy, a hashtag is the pound or number sign used in front of a statement on Twitter or Facebook. The purpose of the hashtag is to aggregate people's posts together. So if I'm on Twitter and I click on the Black Lives Matter hashtag, every post that included that hashtag will be in a list for me to read and ponder. To me, the hashtag makes visible the diversity of people and thoughts that make up a movement. This is important as we consider our collective response to Black Lives Matter, as we have demonstrated quite a wide range of thoughts and feelings about how we should respond or feel about the call to action.
Is there room for all of us here? Do all lives matter? How about blue lives, like my former partner, Mary, who's devoted her life to community policing? And ultimately, do black lives matter as much as all other lives? I've seen so many reactions from our community. Disagreement over the basic premise that black people are experiencing disparate treatment in society. Disagreement over the use of the Black Lives Matter slogan, as it seems to single out a group rather than unifying towards equality, which is generally our goal. Concerns that this is not the fight for white people, that we are falling into our privilege to think that we should lead in this discussion. Concerns about our safety and the safety of other black people in our community if we were to visibly support this message. And concerns about disrespecting and devaluing the police, as much of the more negative rhetoric has been aimed at the criminal justice system and some at police officers specifically. I think it's so important that we continue to have these conversations and figure out for ourselves how we can fit into this bigger movement. However, I do want to say that this movement, similar to the civil rights movement in the 60s, is larger than any one person or any group of people. Alicia Garza, an Oakland area activist, was the first person to use the hashtag Black Lives Matter after Trayvon Martin was killed and his killer was acquitted. These are her words about the civil rights movement she helped to create and inspire, as reported in Yes Magazine. We really felt like there needed to be a space that people could relate to that didn't blame black people for conditions we didn't create. When we began, Black Lives Matter was a series of social media platforms that connected people online to take action together offline. Our diversity in leadership is an important component. We have diverged from a model that is about following one charismatic leader, usually a man who is straight. Love is what sustains us through all the hardships that come with this work, even love for people who disagree. Love is what will ultimately get us to a place where we can change the world we live in. This is me again now. Now, the diversity existing in this movement is part of what I love about it. But the reality of diversity of thought can sometimes be harder to accept than the concept. This means that there will be people in the movement with whom I and many of you disagree on some points. Similar to the diversity represented during the civil rights movement in our history, when some argued for violent action or the separation of races, this movement represents a large group of people with many different ideas on how to move forward. Uniting everyone, however, is the concept that black lives matter as much as any other life, and that we as a country and global community need to work to address systemic issues facing people of color. In his 1963 letter from Birmingham Jail, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, "I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, and who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection." That was in 1963, but I hear his voice calling us now, and I hear the continued truth in his statement. Reverend Melissa Carvel-Zemer recently advised our congregation to read the book The Selma Awakening by Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, which is an historical and theological look at Unitarian Universalism and the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. I found the book then and read it as part of my preparation for today's service, and I urge you all to read it in order to learn more about our collective faith history. Our faith tradition is filled with activists who have stepped out as allies during times of turmoil. And it is also filled with people who were not so sure, with people who can talk about these values and pass resolutions, but not follow through with any direct action. In hindsight, it seems clear to me that it was the right thing for UUs to get involved in the March on Washington in 1963, the actions in Selma in 1965, or other acts of political defiance or civil disobedience during that time. David Johnson, minister of the UU Church in Bloomington, Indiana, shares this memory leading up to the march over the Pettus Bridge. Before 2 days were out, approximately 60 UU ministers had made their pilgrimage to Selma, nearly 10% of our active parish ministry. I was unutterably proud of our presence. But there was no time for pride. We had come because we had to. We were late, very late, 12 years too late. The first voter registration drive was in 1952. They were beaten into submission, beaten on street corners, on the steps of the courthouse, in their own churches, in their own homes, and we did not notice. At the General Assembly last week in Portland, Oregon, the delegates overwhelmingly voted affirmatively to support a resolution titled Support the Black Lives Matter Movement. It urges us to engage in intentional learning in our congregations, organize for racial justice, recognize issues of intersectionality. I'll do another service on that someday. It's too big for this. Work towards police reform and creation of a more just prison system, and connect with local and national movements. A few days ago, in the aftermath of the massacre in Charleston and numerous Southern Black churches burning from as yet unknown causes, Reverend Peter Morales urged us all Unitarian Universalist congregations to address Black Lives Matter in our services today. So where do we go from here? We are being called to do our own work in our communities to address these issues. But what can that look like for the UU Church of Kent, where we have been divided in our support of this cause? Some of us have spent years learning about racial injustice and anti-racism, and we are ready to speak out and speak up publicly in support of the Black Lives Matter movement, hashtag included. But others need more time to learn and process, and others are supportive but not comfortable being on the front lines of activism or potentially putting those in our community at risk for this cause. Still, others may never agree with the basic premise of this movement. We all live in beloved community together, and we will need to find a way to bring our collective voices to the table. In response to Reverend Morales' call to action, I'm hoping that we will devote significant time to this issue in the coming year. All of us need to be a part of this, not just members who've been active in social justice work. In fact, it is all of you who have not been as active that I want to listen to and learn more about how you feel about race in America, and how you can be a part of making our own congregation a more inclusive space for all people. This is very tough personal work, to address one's own bias and privilege. I've done it, and let me tell you, it hurts when you realize that you may not be as colorblind as you would like to believe. I stumble upon my own bias daily, when I read the news and pay more attention when young white women go missing, when I assume Southern white men are prejudiced against Black people or gay people like me, or when I work to broaden the pipeline of qualified IT candidates in my work as a technical recruiter. I catch myself making assumptions, and I try to back up and address it when I can. It is the times when I don't catch myself that keep me awake at night, and I need other people to point out those times so that I can become a stronger ally to the Black community. I am committed to all of you, to this faith community, and to the principles of our faith, which in part call us to uphold and protect the inherent worth and dignity of every person and seek out justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. I will personally commit to being a part of this movement, not only in my own activism work, where I can represent on behalf of our community, but right here in our church home. I will commit my time, energy, and knowledge to helping us grow as individuals and as a community, but I cannot do it alone. You all need to show up to the workshops, listen to the messages, and bring yourself to this movement too. Sometimes standing on the side of love looks like staying in community through the tough discussions, listening, and finding a way to move forward in all of our crazy, beautiful diversity. Amen.
I will stand with you. Will you stand with me? We will be the change that we hope to see. In the name of love, in the name of peace, will you stand with me? When injustice raises up its fist and fights to stop us in our tracks, we will rise and as one resist. No fear nor sorrow can turn us back. I will stand with you. Will you stand with me? We will be the change that we hope to see. In the name of love, in the name of peace, will you stand with me? When pain and hatred churn up angry noise, try to shout down freedom song, we will rise in one joyful voice, loud and clear and ever strong. I will stand. I will stand with you. Will you stand with me? Will you stand with me? We will be the change that we hope to see. In the name of love, in the name of peace, will you stand with me? When broken hearts come knocking at our door, lost and hungry and so alone, we will reach as we have reached before. There is no stranger in this our home. I will stand with you. Will you stand with me? We will be the change that we hope to see. In the name of peace, in the name of peace, will you stand with me? In the name of love, in the name of peace, will you stand with me?
I leave you with these words by Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Blessed be.